Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the May 28th, 2020 forum featuring Corey Thomas, Chairman and CEO of Rapid7. I'm Warren Zola, the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields, who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Corey joined us for a series we call Conversations with CEOs, as he spoke with me and we engaged in a Q&A with our members. The conversation focused on Corey's involvement on Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker's reopening advisory board relative to COVID-19, as well as big picture cybersecurity issues. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. I appreciate all the members for joining us. This is an important way for us to continue to maintain this strong community of leaders that we've cultivated and continue to do our best to engage and educate and learn from each other. Obviously, today's guest is the chair and CEO of Rapid7, Corey Thomas. So Corey, welcome, and thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, thank you for having me, and thanks for all the work you are doing.
Well, and more importantly, and we're gonna get into Rapid7 and cybersecurity, but like many of our guests, you're more concerned about the region and our community, and you've been named and added to Governor Baker's task force that is addressing and helping us shape our response to the pandemic that we're currently facing. You're part of a 17-member response team advisory board, and I'd love to hear a little bit about the mission of that organization and how things are going.
Yeah, no, so I'm speaking on behalf of myself, of course, in this capacity, but I think the governor asked us to look at a specific question is sort of like, how do we reopen and what's the process of reopening? And how do we do that safely as possible based on the science that was available, acknowledging the fact that the science is evolving in and of itself. You know, we rarely find ourselves in a situation where we're actually learning as we actually go. And as a society, we're having to actually apply those learnings as we go to things that are very, very serious, both, you know, health especially, but also the economy. The governor also made clear that the decision about what metrics to use and when it opened was not going to be up to the reopening advisory board. That was going to be left to the scientists in his administration that he was relying on. But the feedback about what the process should be to reopen and how we staged that and how we actually did that as safely as possible, he was looking for recommendations on. And so that was the mandate and the approach. And what we ended up doing was, one, getting lots of advice from lots of different experts around the world, but also we spent time hearing from lots of different constituents in the community. You know, I think you saw stats of over 60 Zoom meetings. This has definitely been one of the more laborious advisory boards that I've participated in a concentrated period. But it was fascinating to see the, and sad in lots of ways, to actually see the impact from both a health perspective and an economic perspective. And what we found was also just a deeply emotional perspective that affected the soul that this was having on our community. And hearing from sort of both community groups, from businesses, from small businesses, we heard from a wide range of people. And then really the way that I think about the task that we tried to put forward was, how do you actually open in stages that allowed you the maximum ability to actually get through the opening phases, the less likelihood of actually having a rebound where you actually have to close back down because the health just got far worse. And so how do you actually maintain the health momentum, open steadily, and ideally get to a good state where things were both open as quickly as possible, but without a high likelihood of regressions. And that's where we spent lots of our time on the project and the initiative.
It's heartening to hear you describe the mission and the directives of this advisory board. Number one, I'm thrilled to live in Massachusetts during these times. I'm always happy to be in Massachusetts, but to hear the fact that it's science that will be leading our response, I think is something that I've always taken for granted. And apparently that's not the case everywhere. And
you know, I think the world of you, Corey. You're on our board. I think you're a fantastic person. I'm not sure I would choose you as the person to say to decide.
No one I know would actually choose me to actually. In fact, you know, people that actually are obsessed with innovation are often sort of like the worst people to actually manage that type of risk. It's so like there was a very specific thing that I think we were looking at, and again, science set the gates, and you saw some of that in the governor's presentation last week.
Yeah, and what I've also, I'm really fascinated by. It makes sense to me, but what I've heard from everyone that we've had on here, and obviously other conversations that we've all had, it seems like once again community is becoming paramount. This area of ours, the city, the region, the state, it's all about community and everyone having to think about others. And that seems to be also how this board is working. Can you tell me just a little bit about what it's like to be in sort of this tight community? Like you said, 60 Zoom meetings, lots of engagement. That seems to be a priority from everyone I hear.
Well, it is. So I think there's a couple, observations that we have to acknowledge. One is while the pain has been felt disproportionately in communities of color and communities without healthcare access, it is a problem that affects all of us. And so like it really knows no boundaries. And so, and one of the things that was very, very clear when you heard some of the experts speak is that it does not take long for a hotspot to pop up. And I think in Massachusetts, we're a little bit unique and rare is because the first hotspot that popped up was related to Biogen, which was a community that we're all familiar with. And so it doesn't take long for one to pop up. And so I'd say, community has a couple different lenses. One is that because we're so interconnected, and especially people that live in the cities and work in offices and other things like there, is that it does not take a lot for this to actually spread. The second thing that's actually very clear is when you think about sort of like opening and maintaining the health and the road to recovery, we're more interconnected than actually ever. And so it's going to be very, very difficult to actually manage the health crisis, more or less the recovery from it, if we actually don't ensure that basically our community actually moves through that as holistically as possible. I mean, I cannot imagine what the character of the city of Boston would be without small businesses and without restaurants. But yet, sort of like many of our restaurants face an existential crisis in and of themselves, is we can't survive in a city where communities of color are devastated and don't have the access and the availability and also suffering the double whammy of economic impact. And so those all have very, very real consequences about whether Boston and our broader community actually comes out and thrives. And so I think it's just an acknowledgement of reality is that health knows no boundaries. Anyone who's studied any sort of like modicum of economics knows that things are interconnected. And especially in this case, sort of like things are very, very tightly interconnected. And so we have to actually find a way to actually really bring the entire community through this together as possible. And there's a very, very real risk if we don't do it well, we actually become more fractured along the way. And that's something that I think everyone should be trying to avoid.
Yeah. And I actually had a really quick flashback when you mentioned economics, going back to my undergraduate major and having to do a couple of charts and graphs and stuff. So excuse me for a second while I relive that memory. But, we had Bob Rivers on earlier, a couple of weeks ago. He talked about the lending for small businesses and the racial gap that's unfortunately there, and the concern that this is both an opportunity but also a real potential negative for the future of our region if we don't respond appropriately. From what you're hearing and seeing on this board and also at Rapid 7 and just in general conversations, do you have a sense of sort of what the future of Massachusetts economy looks like, both short and long term, as it responds and recovers?
So I would say it's to be written. I mean, so far, so the board was just about sort of the recommendation to reopen. And so by and large, that's completed, although we're still meeting to get feedback and share feedback, observations, and learnings along the way. You know, I think the story is actually to be written. It's to be written by the people on this call and us. And I actually think that it's not one that you can actually be passive on. If we do nothing and expect the sort of like the status quo to actually hold, it will be devastating. Like Massachusetts, in our community, Boston, everything around it will regress. It'll regress because we'll have closed down small businesses. restaurants. It'll regress because our communities of colors, which provide the essential workers that we actually have just realized belatedly that we rely on, will be negatively impacted. It'll regress because our city will be less vibrant. Because again, if you look at what's happening all around, is that the trend is actually downward. That said, as I'm fairly optimistic, it can be regressed. Like, we can actually sort of like stop it, and we can actually recover stronger. But the status quo won't actually get the recovery. We actually have to be fairly creative and actually take action to actually figure out how we support small businesses, how we actually support communities of colors. I think I heard Bob point out, many people I know who've actually tried to apply for the PPP loans, that if you actually had connections, you could actually get in the queue. But if you didn't have connections, you couldn't get into the queue. And again, that was something that actually did not occur with this crisis. It actually just got highlighted by the crisis that we're actually in. And so we have to actually say, like, all right, how do you actually provide access to capital for people that are developing connections? And so, but these are solvable problems. How do you actually figure out the fact that most retail and restaurants are actually closed down and they're further and further arrears? So do we really want them to shut down and go bankrupt? And does we want our cityscapes actually covered with boarded up restaurants? And so, but again, action has to be taken. But if you actually look at this, this is a solvable problem, but it doesn't get solved by sort of like sitting on our hands. It gets actually solved by sort of like, one, understanding it, one, saying we actually have to all move forward together, and then taking specific actions that are different than what we've actually done in the past to actually make changes.
I think that's really important to underscore. And, you know, I should mention, by the way, to our members that we will start taking questions from all of you at around the bottom of the hour. Please use the chat to let us know that you have a question, and then we'll start to let people know sort of who's up next, and Lauren and Gail will help manage that. But returning back to your point, Corey, where you talk about sort of the response, I think that's really important. I was reading an interesting article this morning. Actually, a friend of mine, Katie Burke, who works at HubSpot, wrote, and she talks about the Buddhist concept of the second arrow. The first arrow being what happens to you, some sort of incident, and that certainly would be the pandemic of COVID-19 right now, and that causes damage. And there's nothing you can do about that first arrow. The second arrow is how we all respond to it and how we take our own feelings and our compassion and respond to that is something that we very much can control. And it sounds a little bit about that's what you're talking about. The pandemic is here. There's nothing at this point that we can do about it. And what we can control as a community, as business leaders, is our response to make it positive, to make it thoughtful, and based in science, which again is refreshing to hear. I don't want to get too political, but certainly the fact that is something that this region holds dear is fantastic. Are there particular industries that you see that are going to be impacted sort of negatively or positively in ways that most of us haven't considered yet?
I would say that I suspect that not in ways that you actually haven't considered. Like the, you know, if you can walk through them all, and some of them are blindly obvious. I think, you know, my industry, tech, is somewhat fortunate in cybersecurity where there's demand. But, you know, the one that I think about to get prioritized in my mind when I look at this is, you know, is the first thing is that, one, we actually have a crisis in our medical community. And while they're responding, is you see masses of sort of like furloughs, layoffs. And when you think about sort of the healthcare ecosystem, including the dentist ecosystem, which are many small businesses and other things, is that there's a crisis there that has to be addressed. It's addressable, but we actually have to address it. When you think about sort of the, really what I think about sort of like the retail community and how that actually relates to both these small businesses, the minority-owned and people of color-owned and Black-owned businesses. When you think about the restaurants and other things there, these are things that sort of like are not just in the communities as sources of job engines. They also very much color like how do things actually look and sort of like, do we want to be part of this? And sort of like, does it actually feel vibrant? And so there are public symbols that are actually there. And, you know, and the entire retail and restaurant industry is just closed down. And I talked to more and more of them that actually don't have a path forward. Again, a solvable problem, because it's really, we have to figure out how to address both the, what do we do about the rents that have actually happened, and then how do we actually make that achievable as we actually reopen? It's a solvable problem, but there's many, many small businesses that are actually going to be negatively impacted that's actually there. So from an industry perspective, the healthcare, the retail, the hospitality, travel and restaurant industries are the ones that actually stand out, that actually are a core part of our fabric, that are actually there. The other one that's actually most obvious, if, you know, I think what's perverse in some ways about this and the impact on the Boston community is Boston has actually had the luxury almost of every single recession I can actually think of having a core set of industries that are recession proof. And when we think about education and healthcare, we think about these as not impacted regardless of the recession or anything that actually happens. And in this case, this is an attack on basically any industries that actually requires close contact. And so our education industries, and in addition to the healthcare, which I actually talked about earlier, are severely impacted here. And so we have some peculiar things that are different this time around that we'll actually have to address. Now, our educators are actually working hard to actually make sure that there's a safe way to actually return students to campus. And I actually think that they have a good strategy for that. But there are some very peculiar things that are sort of typical strengths for Boston and for the state of Massachusetts, for the Commonwealth, that we are having to actually struggle with and address right now. And they are addressable, but it's just not easy.
Well, obviously I work at Boston College, and this is the first time that I have not been on campus with any regularity since the early 1990s. And thinking about what that industry is facing and how we're going to come back together to educate. And, you know, you're right. It's such a, we have so many communities here in Boston that are based on close contact that seemingly were recession proof and clearly are not, or at least not, safe from
this case.
Yeah. From this current environment. But I think in many ways, this is, you hate to sort of apply Darwinian principles to this, but I think it is helping many industries reshape and rethink about, you know, what matters and the services and how they deliver and continuing to be successful and profitable for their employees and staff, but also knowing that, you know, maybe the way things have always been done, you know, does not have to continue in that way. And so I think that's one of the good that we can pull from this.
Well, I think that, so, you know, inertia is a powerful pull to go along things. And in fact, you know, my general attitude, and we've definitely applied this to my company, but I'm seeing this applied more globally, is that this is an opportunity to address the stuff that we've always known we should be doing, but there was always a reason not to actually do it. So if you take the, what's happening in the medical profession with telehealth is just fascinating. That was a slow thing that always was a crappy experience that you actually had to make an appointment, go see someone in person, just to actually get a brief diagnostic. And we've actually transferred to telehealth overnight and we'll never go back. It's a better experience for doctors, it's a better experience for patients, but inertia is just such a powerful draw because we've always done it this way. And I think we have that all over the board. I think that we have to take that same momentum and say like, all right, why does it take sort of like, why is it so difficult to actually get access to capital in different communities? We have to take the same approach and say, all right, how do we actually make it easier for people that are actually sick to actually be able to actually stay home and actually not have to be compelled to actually go into work? There's places all over the board where we've actually sort of had inertia. And by the way, Massachusetts has addressed some of these, but inertia has been a powerful force. I think as industries actually go through it, I can't think of a single industry that's actually not looking at this. My own, in fact, included, is sort of the tech industry, which is actually, you know, has been lots written about the tech industry and its lack of diversity in hiring. And I've talked before about the fact that we sort of tend to, that is an outcropping of elitism, and we only hire from a few schools. And we've actually started to move past that. We've hired from more schools and started to actually slowly see more diversity in tech. But now we're actually looking at it and say like, okay, we actually have sort of like some regional elitism, and why can't I actually hire people in different parts of the state and different parts of the country? And so all of these things are sort of like, why not, as we actually go solve these problems. And I think that it's an opportunity for us not just to survive it, but to actually come out of it better for the next crisis that we may see.
Yeah, and I think what's important here, and I see that we're having some questions, and we'll turn to those in just a couple of minutes. So don't forget your question. But one of the things that I think is important is sort of this, an evolution, right? It's a learning process, both for organizations and individuals. The crack research team of the Boston College Chief Executives Club went back and found a commencement address that you gave, where you talked about early in your career wanting to think about being a disruptor and being innovative. And over time that you shift a little bit more towards trying to build things and bring people together. And talk to me a little bit about how that change has shaped what you're doing and where you guys are going, both yourself and at Rapid7.
Yeah, so it's the concept that I had is sort of like, you know, everyone thinks about sort of how they leave their mark on the world. And you tend to, at least I'm drawn to sort of like what are the hardest problems that you're going to actually face at any point in time. And I'm part of an industry that's actually, the hardest problems you face is how do you actually break something that's inefficient and make it more efficient and therefore create a greater company out of it. I think what became abundantly clear, both even if you're actually disrupting, but more broadly, is you were getting lots of people that were having sort of this confluence of things. One, it's easier to break things than to build them. And so like, it's just much, much easier to actually break things than to actually build them. The second thing that I think you're actually seeing was essentially every single, what I would call institutional organization that people had confidence in, people actually start to have a lack of confidence in, whether it was the church, whether it was government, whether it was business, no matter what it was, you actually saw a lack of confidence in different institutions. And so for me, the problem shifted is sort of, you know, how do you actually build great institutions that actually build trust and actually do good work and actually are profitable, successful, make money, but how do you actually do the and there? My team, jokingly, no one goes to the office, but if you look on my desk, my team jokingly gave me this big ampersand that sits on the desk because, you know, the tyranny of the or doesn't matter. It's sort of like you have to actually build great organizations and you actually have to sort of like be profitable and you actually have to find ways to actually tie them into communities. And for me, that concept of building things and actually tying things together seemed like a challenge that was actually worthwhile because it was hard, it was actually difficult. And in some ways that became disruptive because it was against the status quo. And so that became a curiosity and a passion for me.
That's great. And I love the concept of this ampersand as a gift to you to think about what that signifies for all of us. And I know that we've got some questions from our members. I know that Carol Fulp, who probably has dedicated her career as well as anybody I know to the ampersand, has a question for you. So Carol, why don't you take yourself off mute and join us and ask your question of Corey.
Thank you. Thank you for this very interesting dialogue, Warren and Corey. Corey, could you give us your thoughts on this? Here we have a devastating pandemic that has affected every zip code that we know. And it has also shed this light on the challenging racial inequities that have always been with us. As we look and see who's been most impacted by this pandemic. And so we see, as all of us know, Black and brown and yellow and red people most affected. How can we address these inequities at this particular time, yet also be sensitive to the fact that everybody is being impacted by this pandemic?
Yeah, so I think it's both a not just very astute and accurate. It's probably one of the critical questions, I think, as we actually go through it. This is just my take on thinking about this exact question is, and I hate to emphasize the ampersand again, you have to act with vigor right now. And so there's things we can do now, and you have to actually sort of address some of the structural things that set up the dynamic that impact the community. So with vigor right now, I actually think that we have to actually, and the state has actually taken steps to actually do this, but we have to continue to do it aggressively, is we have to actually put the testing, the healthcare, and the care and treatment in the hands and in the spots where the communities are most impacted. And so the ability for people in those communities to get tested quickly, to have a care plan, to address basic things like food access, which is so critical sort of like in those things. Those are things that actually we can't wait to actually solve the root cause problem. we have to actually address now. So I think about it something like it's a dual thing right now, is don't do so much analysis to actually that allows you to delay the action we know we can actually take. There's absolute action that we can and should be taking right now, and we have to be taking that with sort of like all vigor and all urgency. And that has been my constant encouragement. And there's progress being made there, but not enough. And this is one where I think we all can actually be contributing because, you know, whether it's testing, whether it's sort of access to actual care post-testing, whether it's sort of like how do you actually deal with the fact that lots of these communities live together? So how do you provide separate spaces so people can actually have comfort but not actually get the rest of their families sick? And how do you provide access to food? These are all things that we can actually solve. Why can we solve them? Well, if you break it down, it's testing. We're ramping that, but we can make sure they go to the right communities. The care, we actually have lots of doctors that are sort of like could be brought to bear, but they actually are in the wrong areas. And so we have to reapply them. And I know the healthcare ecosystem is doing some work there. But we also have, you know, hotels and facilities that are actually sitting open. And we actually have people that are actually making other people in their buildings and they're actually family sick. And we actually have a strategy. By the way, for all the criticism that's been placed on China, some of these areas they actually did much more effectively than the U.S. has actually done in response. The ability to actually put people in spaces where they were actually cared for and did not make their families sick, from everything I've read, is they got to a place that's actually better than what we're actually seeing in the U.S. And then we actually have to address what are the things that actually led up to basically these communities being impacted. And that's the systematic stuff, of which there's some mysteries and there's some non-mysteries that are actually there. And so the non-mysteries we have to address is we've had a health inequality issue for a very long time. And this is sort of a thing that our family is passionate about. But that is the access to care. Do we listen to actually people or do we disdain them as they're actually getting care? So what's the experience of the care and the quality of care that they actually get? In our own family, I've been in doctor's offices where family members are describing symptoms and the doctors are actually sort of saying like, no, it's just because you're XYZ and it's actually dismissed. And I've had the good fortitude to actually be able to afford sort of like specialists. And it turns out that we have multiple doctors who just ignored it. And so these are all sort of like systematic issues that we have to actually address. You know, the only thing that I would actually say is that I do feel in some of these issues, and I think it's going to become more important later, is that we cannot wait till we have the comprehensive solution to start addressing the problems that we know exist today. And so like, as we see problems, we have to have a pace and an urgency to solve them as we see them. And I think sometimes, especially in communities like Massachusetts, where we tend to have some very thoughtful, theoretical people, we tend to wait till we have comprehensive understanding before we take action. And I actually think that is not the right strategy or approach right now. And I think we're learning lots of stuff with the pandemic that's actually teaching us that we can actually take action as we learn versus wait till we actually have a grand strategy that everyone agrees with.
Thank you.
If we have some more questions, it looks like we've got one here from John Griffin. So John, I will cede the floor to you. So unmute yourself and ask away. Are you there?
Yes, sorry.
There we go.
On the unmuting, I had to push several buttons for fear. I mute myself repeatedly. But anyway, thanks for giving me the floor. I think contact tracing will be an important topic to limit resurgence, you know, once you have a positive test in any community. We've been seeing different commercial firms jump into this opportunity and offer competing technical high-tech products that could execute contact tracing for somebody who wanted it to protect their firm, protect their community, what have you. Given your position, how do you think contact tracing will evolve? It seems like that private approach is going to be less inclusive than a government approach or more centralized approach, but the centralized approaches are probably getting some privacy pushback. So yeah. The question was, how do you see contact tracing evolving?
So you're right. And for background, I think everyone's aware, but contact tracing is just sort of like, when someone is identified as having COVID-19, mm-hmm. Who are all the people that they came into contact with, close contact with in a period of time. So I think there's a couple of things. It's one is if you're going to address it clearly, there's sort of like four prongs that you have to address. It's, you know, one, mask and social distancing mandatory, testing and expanding testing capacity and putting it in the right places mandatory, and then contact tracing, because that actually limits it to your point. This is, I think contact tracing is one where we will not be leaders in the world in, because I think it's sort of like a part of the, it strains the culture and the fabric, I think, of the U.S. more. If you think the mask wearing are causing cultural wars, wait till you actually tell people that you got to do what they did in China and they see, I know where you are at every moment in time. I just don't think it's achievable. And so this is where I think we have to be practical for where we are. And I think you have to pick your spots. I think our spots that the consensus has emerged around is mask and social distancing. We're going to down that hill. Testing, we can actually solve that with investment. And so we'll actually do that. And contact tracing will be there, but it'll be suboptimal and it'll be a hodgepodge. Because I don't think any government has the willingness, and frankly, the conversation I've had both at the state and the local level believes that they can actually win actually enforcing systematic contact tracing like they did in China and some other parts where we have to know where every person is at every moment in time. And so I think that's going to be suboptimal. So if you think about then, okay, if it's suboptimal, how do you actually make the system as efficient as possible? There's a couple observations. One, the best thing, which you're not going to actually get, which would be an opt-in federal framework, where you actually had a federal framework that was not mandatory, but opt-in, because that would actually take out lots of the, and in fact, you could have multiple technologies that use it, but it actually went through the same clearinghouse, just like we have a unified banking system that actually has the same clearinghouse where you have multiple banks with the same infrastructure there. That by far would be the best in my mind, because it will set up a dynamic where if companies opted in or people opted in, is you would at least get a large part of the population on the opt-in and not have the fragmentation. I don't think we're going to get that sort of like leadership sort of at that level. And so then in the in-between, should the state encourage something like that? It's hard to actually for that to be effective on a 50 state by state basis. And so I think what Massachusetts has done is reasonable, is that they've actually hired an army of contact tracers, and they're doing it the old school manual way, not the technology way. And that has some level of efficacy. Like, it actually works. Does it work as good as if you had the full opt-in? No. Does it work as good if it was mandatory? No. But again, I think this is one area. I think of the four, this is the area where we're going to have to be sub-optimized. Because I don't, again, my personal take is I don't think it's worth, and I don't think we can down the hill actually taking away privacy to that extent.
That's great. And we've got another question. It's from Diana Pisciotta. So Diana, again, unmute yourself and welcome.
And go great. Ahead. Corey, thank you. And I appreciate what you were saying about how we were able to quickly transition in so many ways to strategies and technologies that we had considered not workable a few short months ago. One thing that we've noticed both within our company and across many clients is that the short-term nature of this work from home period has nicely connected to doing tasks and tactics very effectively in the work from home environment. But over the longer term, there's some concern among a number of our clients that strategy, innovation, mentoring, things that really benefit from a shared environment are going to be negatively impacted by this, even when we're back in a more constrained office setting with a lot of restrictions. Any thoughts from your end or the conversations you've been having about what collectively we can do as a community to maintain that sense of connectedness that fosters really great innovation and fresh new thinking, and so that we don't inadvertently fall a little bit behind? It seems funny to say that during a period when I know so many Boston businesses are leading in the health sciences space on vaccines and therapies and all of those other things. But I'm thinking more than just at the margins, but that in a lot of places, we could look back 18 months from now and say, oh, we missed this piece of the puzzle, and now we're having to catch up on some of those lost experiences.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great, and the way that I think about this, trying to sort of like frame it out, is sort of like there's really two aspects. It's one, there's something that is special about connection. that is sort of like generative, that's creative, but like connection actually we know really, really matters. And it's also matters for the well-being and all the other stuff. And so how do you actually sort of like navigate to a place of how do we actually not lose it, but then how do we get back to this connectedness that's actually there? And then the other one is about the creative process itself, and the innovative spark that actually happens when things collide, and how do you actually nurture that through this period? And then how do you actually get back to it? So I'll talk about both of those, the connectedness and the innovation, because I actually think that these are examples, and we've talked about this in my company, so take this sort of one example, what I actually think could get better. And we put a challenge about like, how do we become closer? And as we exit this, how does it actually get better as you come out of the otherness? So connectedness, we're doing a couple pilots, but like there's some interesting things. So one, in the UK right now, we have a pilot to actually see how it works, is on the connectedness, is they're shifting to basically a field day model. So think about this, is once a month, they're actually taking field trips as teams and actually going out and taking walks through nature, or doing other things where it's socially distanced, it's outside, it's actually wearing masks. But like they're doing more consistent team building actually now. And it's sort of like this field day model. What they're talking about work is actually going to do it, but it's expanding the notion of that we only connect in a building. And it turns out that basically there's other ways to connect and create outside of just sort of like the physical buildings. And that can actually be a boon and a positive. So the question I think, and the challenge is, and this didn't come from me, this came from our head of global operations, who was having the same operations, is he put the challenge down as sort of like, how do we actually deepen connections when buildings aren't safe? And I thought it was a great framing. And so we have lots of people that are actually going out doing their own pilots and experiments about like, can we actually do that? And so that's sort of like one thing about the connections as you actually come through. The second part is, I'm going to tie both the connections and the innovations together, is that every organization that I'm aware of has, I think, a tendency to silo in some way, and a tendency to actually sort of like focus on the team in and of itself. And you always are sort of like working to actually resist that and to actually build more connection and to build it tighter to your customer. I think there's two things I think are interesting. One, I think this Zoom experience has actually equalized the people that are sort of in headquarters versus the people that are distributed around. And that's actually been an incredibly positive thing that we can't lose as we actually go forward for larger companies that are actually there. But in some ways, if you look at the productivity of the remote workforces that are actually been there, it's actually gone up because it's less of a mystery about how you get information, and the tribalism that happens actually has decreased. And so that's a positive thing. The second thing that we're likely going to experiment is that we actually go back to work is we may eliminate this is sort of controversial, so don't repeat this because I think our team is still finding out about this, is we're probably going to start eliminating the notion of that you sit with your team. And we're start sort of embracing is sort of like you actually sit with basically what your team can be and should be right now. So it's more dynamic in orientation. And it encourages this sort of like cross-functional ideation generation instead of this stagnant thing that basically I sit with the same set of people based on function over time versus I sit with a team that actually solves a customer problem. And that's dynamic. And I'm working with this set of team for this period of time, and I'm going to be working for this set of team for this period of time. And I think that basically the disruption of the workforce and how people sit and the fact that we have the social distance and we have to move people around allows us and is forcing us to think about how do you actually generate more creativity as you go forward. And this whole thing about basically a more fluid definition of sort of like purpose-driven teams and organizing around purpose-driven teams is one of the things that we're looking at, we think will actually make us net better on the other side. So those are just two examples of sort of like how we actually are trying to think about addressing some of this.
I think it's fascinating to think about how this pandemic is going to be shaping business moving forward. I think it's going to be absolutely remarkable in 20, 30, maybe 5 years to look back and think, I can't believe how we did things in January of 2020 versus how we do things now and how things have gotten more efficient. Just absolutely remarkable. So hopefully there will be some good that will come from all this in terms of efficiency and changes in the workplace. We've got a couple more questions. Barry Sloan, you're up next, and then Stephen Ford. While Barry unplugs or unmutes himself, I do want to mention, Diana did mention mentoring. I would be remiss, I'm on the board at Mass Mentoring Partnership, if I didn't mention that there are a lot of people out there that need mentors. We can do it virtually. Get involved in any way you can. Mass Mentoring is a great way to do it. There's other places to do it. Enough of my PSA. Barry, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Warren. Good morning, everybody. So I just wanted to make a comment, if I could, Corey, in defense of the Triple P, which in my view was the miracle of the federal support in this pandemic. You know, we alone made 1,200 loans, some $250 million, you know, from as little as 10,000 to as much as 5 million. And the largest loans all went to not-for-profits serving the community. So, I mean, we estimate in our case alone, there's probably 10,000 people working as a result of the support. And I would certainly, there's no doubt that in version one, it was chaos. It was chaos to set it up, to get approved, to get applications. And it was fascinating to watch where a highly sophisticated CFO-based organization would file an application with three wrong questions and would then go to the end of the line where a local merchant for 10 grand got it all right because he and his wife filled it out. So there's no doubt that that was, there was the equity was only in the resourcefulness in that first part. But I have to say, you know, chapter two, which is still open, there are still billions in the authorization. The applications have trickled to almost nothing. And we've gone from hundreds a day to dozens a day to now perhaps one a day. So I'm a little perplexed. I mean, anybody who wants to apply, you know, will be seen, so to speak, and will be considered. And there's still, you know, billions left. We've reached out, you know, quite significantly through our CRA officers to talk to the community organizations that we've had long relationships with where we've done housing projects. Hey, if somebody doesn't understand it, doesn't know the forms, can't fit, you know, we'll sit with them, and we're getting very little response. So I'm a little perplexed. I can't explain that. Somebody undoubtedly will examine this in a more academic way at some point. But you know, the window is wide open still. I don't think for too much longer, maybe another couple of weeks, maybe it could be longer, but I think this has more or less been a national phenomenon. It's worthy of some study to try to understand why people of the smallest, most disadvantaged businesses haven't raised their hand.
Now, by the way, I think the PPP program has been essential and necessary. I actually think it's actually going well for lots of people. You know, there's two things I would point out. I think that sort of like continue this thread is, I think just because something's imperfect doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Because I actually think we have to sort of like do it and acknowledge it. I think this is a great example. I think that we could also acknowledge that everything can always be sort of like better and improved as you actually go through successive waves. And so sure. I think about this one as a little one is sort of like, it was actually good and let's continue to hone it to make sure that like it's available and accessible. And it is a great sort of like question because I continue to hear from people that have struggled, and maybe it was just sort of like in the first phase to actually figure out how to actually get into the queue. And then it went so fast. But I also know that like, I know lots of businesses where it was a lifesaver and a game changer for. So I completely agree with the sentiments there.
Thank you.
Wonderful. I think we have time for at least one more question. Stephen Ford, you are up next. And then we'll probably go to lightning round because we do want to end at the top of the hour to be respectful. As you know, our hallmark is ending on time. But Stephen, you are up.
Okay. Thank you, Warren. Corey, a lot of the leaders that we're talking to these days are really struggling with how to evolve their leadership at this particular time. By the way, there's a big difference between those businesses that have had to significantly change how they operate and the ones who haven't, because in certain areas of manufacturing, they haven't had to close and they're not evolving as much. And I think that's going to play out in different ways. But how has your leadership style evolved during this time, and how do you expect it to continue to evolve?
I would say the biggest net, and by the way, you know, for background, just to be clear, is that we haven't had to do layoffs and we're still growing at a less rate. So we are fortunate. So I don't want to also over do it. I would say the single biggest change though that I've actually had to make is I've had to actually get much more comfortable being transparently vulnerable. And so, we've switched to sort of like, there's two big switches that are functional, but I'll sort of like talk about what they actually mean is I sort of like meet with our entire company every week. And then basically twice a day, I meet with a random set of people throughout the company. And the goal is for me sort of like every day to actually meet with about 15 people in the company for informal sessions and Q&As. And really what's come is that this is the first time that at least at this magnitude, I always thought myself as sort of like being willing to be vulnerable and transparent, is I've had to say, listen, I don't know and I can't control the pandemic. I can't control the recession. And I'm learning as I actually go through it. And so I can't give you certainty, but what I can actually give you is sort of like, here's the principles we're gonna live by, here's what we're learning. Which wasn't the notion of sort of like leadership that had always been sort of had always been taught. And so, and we're going to actually be decisive and take action. And I've always thought about great leadership as sort of like being a level of consistency that was actually there. I think that's valuable. But in this case, it's sort of been vulnerable to say, listen, I don't control it. So here's what I think right now. And it could be tomorrow, I actually tell you. In fact, I'm going back to like, you know, what I told you 2 weeks ago is foundationally wrong, and we're gonna have to actually shift. And so this type of sort of like vulnerability around the fluency of like, we don't control the pandemic or the economy, but yet and still we're gonna sort of like be transparent about the mid-process thinking versus the resolved thinking about sort of like, all right, typically communication happens when we have a, not certainty, but a higher degree of certainty, is people are seeing how the sausage is made right now. With high levels of transparency. And that is actually new. It's also, we've got overwhelmingly positive feedback for our team, even though it's stressful for many of our leaders, because it's never any fun to say, you know what, like that thing I told you was completely off. And so like, here's the adjustment that we're making. Or we thought we were gonna do this and it's not working, so we're gonna stop. We know we just geared a bunch of people up to do this, but we're actually gonna stop and shift over here. So that type of dynamic, while trying to provide stability in an uncertain period, has been a difficult sort of like balancing act to provide more transparency, but at the same time provide stability for people to actually feel that they have some certainties in their life, has been sort of a daily balance with our leadership team.
Great, thank you.
I think that's an absolutely wonderful answer, Corey. The leadership sort of tenets that you've outlined have been echoed from others who have joined us. I know John Fish spoke recently as well. And this concept of vulnerability, something that leaders are acknowledging now, it's an iterative process, but acknowledging the importance of that we don't have all the answers, that we are vulnerable, but we're going to be transparent in how we address and approach things, I think has been remarkable. And John actually talked a lot about needing to open ourselves up for love as well. Again, I think that is such an important component of how we respond to that second arrow, as we discussed earlier. It's 10 of, so I'd like to flip the switch a little bit. I know that there's a couple of questions that we didn't get to answer, but I do like to go into a lightning round where we get a little bit more personal. We learned a little bit about the CEO and his or her sort of background in leadership. So I'm going to shift to those questions. The first question I'm going to ask, Corey, is what's the last book that you read?
Oh, The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. It was recommended by a friend of mine, just to think about sort of like, you know, another crisis that's far removed that was sort of like navigated through. So it's a great read about sort of like England through sort of like parts of World War II and the bombing of London and the events before and after.
That's a great one. Eric Larson is, for those who haven't, is a fantastic author. Certainly should look his stuff up. But I have not read that one, so I will dutifully add it to my list. What's the last music album or playlist that you've sought out and listened to? Not something that was forced upon you by someone else.
Well, okay. Well, that's the. I don't know. It's a combination. So my sons go to bed music is actually Norah Jones, Come Away With Me. And so like it happens to be the last thing that I listen to because like it's his nightly sort of like routine is when I put him to sleep. That's his favorite thing. So we played that in the background.
How old is he?
He's six.
Oh man, that is a great album and a great mm-hmm. artist. My wife and I saw her down in New Orleans. And then again up here in Boston when she came through. And I was stunned in person that her voice is that crystal and spectacular. It's not based on just sort of the CD. Exactly. I get to date myself. It's not just based on electronics. Yeah. So anyways, what was your first paying job?
I was a janitor for a set of local churches in Georgia. My father sort of like, you know, as a side job on the weekends, end of the weeks, actually did cleaning of churches, and I was his assistant that's actually there. So that started at 14.
Wow, that's a little bit early and a different type of job, but that must have taught you some skills as well.
Oh, it did. It was you learn a lot about the things that people say and how they actually behave. So, yeah.
Which you've brought with you today as the leader of Rapid 7, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the fundamental things is sort of like how you treat people matters, because it's interesting about how people treat janitors and janitors' kids. So
yeah. What's your favorite guilty food? No one's looking. You flipping on your favorite show of some kind or listening to Norah Jones. What is it that you're scarfing down?
I'm just scarfing down a grilled cheese. Like it is sort of like I play around with the cheeses and the melting, but I've always sort of like been sort of a big fan of the grilled cheese sandwich. So.
And is there something that you always put next to the grilled cheese that you always have to have, you know, this tomato soup or pretzel? Is there something that goes along with
it? It varies. So that's the beauty of it. It's sort of like, you know, like my favorite ones are everything from the soup to the Honeycrisp apples, which I actually love with a good grill, with a good grilled cheese. And so it actually varies what you actually put with it. But I would say the Honeycrisp apples and the occasional soup are sort of like top of the list.
We usually do this in the early afternoon, but now it's, you know, heading towards lunchtime and I'm starting to think about grilled cheese. So thank you. I'm going to have to see what we've got in the fridge as we prepare that for a future meal. As those of you who have joined us for the previous sessions of these conversations with CEOs, you know that I like to end with what we call a message of hope. This is something that we ask our guests to give us a positive message that we can all leave here and think about. I also should note that in addition to all of these conversations being posted on our YouTube channel now, I've pulled together all of these messages of hope from our CEOs. And also after today's event, we'll add this one for a single video. So for those of you who would like to hear these messages of hope from all of our guests through these conversations, go to our YouTube channel. We'll send you a link. So with that intro, Corey, I once again pose to you, would you please provide us and our members with a message of hope, something we can take away with us after this call?
So I think especially this applies in Massachusetts. I think we actually have one of the unique abilities to actually leverage our strong community. I mean, you heard from people today, you heard it from, you know, I've been so impressed. We have sort of like, I think government who's actually trying to actually figure it out and actually cares. I think we have like different industries and communities. You heard it from Barry about what the impact of the financial community is actually doing. I've seen that from Bob. I think we actually have a community that cares and we have to make changes anyway. I mean, the great thing about the COVID crisis and the recession is we're going to have to change. Like it's just going to have to change. And so if you can combine the impetus to change and the people that care and the fact that we actually entered this crisis in a reasonable position, like meaning we weren't so weak as we actually entered this crisis, we can actually have a recovery that is actually good for all constituents and organizations in the Commonwealth. And I actually think that not many places can actually say that. And that's what I'm hopeful, is that we have people that care. We came in a reasonable position and we have to change anyway. So let's just change it in a way that actually makes the Commonwealth healthy and strong and brings as many people and brings everyone along. And I think that that's why I feel good to be here.
That's great. I mean, if we can't take solace in the opportunity in front of us in the community that we've built and continue to build, then we will have learned nothing. But I am so pleased with the fact that so many people are talking about these opportunities, these positive things that we have a chance to do to reshape, to improve as a result of this pandemic that we're all dealing with and working from home and everything else. So that's wonderful. Thank you. I should also mention that now that we're wrapping up, another sort of quick PSA on behalf of Boston College and anybody else you know who is out of college. There are a lot of students out there looking for opportunities and internships and jobs. So if anybody here has some ideas or possibilities, certainly let us know. We could put you in touch with any of the Boston College students, either undergrad, graduating, or graduate students. There's a lot of talent out there looking to do something to be part of this community to move things forward. But on that note, again, I'd like to thank everybody here, all of our members for their ongoing engagement, joining us both today, but in the past and the future, and being part of this fabric of a community that we've built. Again, thank you to Lauren and Gail for helping me with technology and helping me, if not master, at least make my way through it. And Corey, thank you again so much for your message, for your insight, for what you're doing on behalf of all of us with the governor in helping us get back to a better place safely and quickly. So Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Warren, thank you. And I want to thank everyone that's here today for all the work that they're doing in the community. So thank you all. And thank you, Warren.
So that's great. Thanks to everyone for being here. We will reconvene again virtually via Zoom in a couple of weeks with Linda Henry from the Boston Globe. We've got another event later in June with the chair and CEO of Dow, Jim Fitterling. But for now, have a wonderful end of May. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay part of this community. Take care, everyone.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Corey Thomas, Chair and CEO of Rapid7. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.